Today on Dana's Low Carb for Life, we learn what the Atkins diet really says, hear about Dana's adventures in gluten-free land, and more. So stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey, gang. Welcome to this rather late episode 28 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, brought to you by CarbSmart.com, your smart choice for a low-carb lifestyle. Today, I'm going to dispel a very common myth about the Atkins diet, give you an idea where I stand on the whole net carbs concept. I'm going to fill you in on how things are going with my new gluten-free status, and we are indeed going to talk about low-carb school lunches for the kids, finally, with a very helpful call from a listener on low-carb voices later on, so you're going to want to hear that. First, though, right up front, I want to offer my heartiest congratulations to my dear friend, low-carb blogger and podcaster extraordinaire, Jimmy Moore. This week, Jimmy has reached his 500th podcast. 500! Woo-hoo! I'm up to a big 28. Sheesh. Jimmy is the man. He really is. And he gets some amazing interviews. I mean, Jimmy has interviewed anybody who's anybody in the low-carb community, whether they're doctors or researchers or bloggers or whoever. He's interviewed them. And of course, he's also gotten, and this is the one that really impresses me, some of the most vehement anti-low-carb people to come and be interviewed by him, which is just an amazing feat. I mean, he got Dean Ornish for crying out loud. And I know how hard Jimmy works to get these people to come up with good questions to ask him, the whole thing. Jimmy and I come from the same place. No, no, no. I am not talking geographically. He's a Southern gentleman. I'm a Jersey girl. No, no. We're both people who were so startled, so gobsmacked, so completely dazzled by how much better we felt, how easily we lost weight, how much less our hunger was, how much healthier we were when we went low carb, that we felt this overwhelming urge to tell everybody, to grab total strangers by the lapels and go, no, no, that low fat thing is a lie. You have to try this. You can call it the Emperor's New Clothes syndrome or phenomenon. We both got hit by it in spades. And it changed not only our diets and our health, but our whole lives, and especially our professional lives, of course. Now, of everyone working on the internet, my guess is that Jimmy has by far the biggest following. I mean, everybody working in low carb, largely on the internet. I'm guessing Jimmy has the biggest following, deservedly so. And that means, of course, that he has probably been the front porch, the first, you know, first source of information online for a whole lot of new low carbers. He's out there doing the evangelical work, practically, you know, just telling people what's going on. And he's doing that, I think, more than any other blogger or podcaster. And that means very simply that Jimmy Moore is changing lives and saving lives. So congratulations, Jimmy. All the respect, all the love. Dude, and I'll see you on the cruise in May. Guys, you got to come on the cruise in May and come meet me and Jimmy and a whole bunch of other cool people. I'll have Kevin, the producer, put up a link to Jimmy's site at our show page, danaslowcarbforlife.com. We'll also do the low-carb cruise link again. But it's really, really easy to remember Jimmy's URL. It's livinlavidalowcarb.com. That's not living La Vida Low Carb. It's livin La Vida Low Carb. I am also, other announcement, I am excited to announce that 300 low-carb slow cooker recipes is now available from Amazon.com. Yay! If you have pre-ordered your book, you should already have your copy. We'd love to have you go to Amazon.com and review it. Please, please. And just so everyone who hasn't ordered yet is clear, this 300 low-carb slow cooker recipes is a reissue of my original slow cooker book, 200 low-carb slow cooker recipes, with 100 new recipes. I just don't want anybody who has the original to order this book and then be all disappointed because two-thirds of the recipes are the ones in the first book. But it is expanded by 50%. That's 100 new recipes. And I got to tell you, folks, that nice boy I married and I are still eating the leftovers from developing the slow cooker recipes. Yes, there are still some leftovers in the freezer. I would also, up front here, like to offer a brief apology for how very late this podcast is. It's been over 2 weeks since the last one. But I have to add that I cannot guarantee that I'm not going to be late again. I'm sorry for that, but sometimes things in the rest of my life just go nuts and something has to get delayed, you know. And I have a couple of projects that are being discussed right now. I don't know how either of them are going to go, but if either of them comes through, things are going to get a whole lot busier around here before they get calmer. I will not desert the podcast. I promise you that, nor will I desert the blog. Honestly, they were just way too much fun, but you know, I can only do what I can do. Okay, let's get to the show. In a little bit, we're going to be talking about the whole gluten-free thing, and we're going to get some ideas for low-carb lunchbox food. But first, I want to lay a common myth about the Atkins diet to rest once and for all. But first, I'm going to have a slurp on my LaCroix sparkling water. No, LaCroix does not pay me to say that. I just like the stuff. I recently got an email from a reader who, among other things, said that she tried the Atkins diet, but said it was so impossible because it had no fruits and vegetables. This is a pretty common misconception, actually, and it's often repeated by, you know, clueless reporters who are, you know, talking about low-carb diets and haven't bothered to read the book. Many people figure that they're doing Atkins by eating nothing but meat and eggs, because after all, that's what their friends told them the Atkins diet was. So I thought it would be a good idea to lay this particular myth to rest right here and now. So let me say it clearly and for the record, the Atkins diet does not ban fruits and vegetables. Am I clear here? Really, it doesn't. It never did. It does ban fruit for the first 2 weeks during what is called the induction phase of the diet. And apparently a whole lot of reporters in particular seem to mistake the induction phase of Atkins for the whole thing. During induction, carbs are kept to 20 grams per day or fewer. But even in this induction phase, this very, very low carb phase, not only are you permitted to eat vegetables, you're required to eat vegetables. The diet prescribes them. Induction dieters are told that they are to eat 2 cups of salad vegetables or very low-carb cooked vegetables per day. This includes the vast, vast majority of vegetables, all leafy greens, cauliflower and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and cucumbers, tomatoes, green beans, bell peppers, celery, mushrooms, artichokes, avocados, eggplant, onions. I mean, really, it is far, far easier to list all the vegetables that are not allowed during induction than to list the ones that are. If you skip corn, peas, carrots, potatoes, and sweet potatoes, you should be fine during induction. And actually, I occasionally eat small quantities of peas and carrots, both, now that I'm, you know, long, 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 long past any kind of induction thing. Well, since many Americans never look at a vegetable that isn't the lettuce and tomato on their burger or the fries sitting next to it, this means that a whole lot of people will be eating more vegetables than they formerly did, even on this very strict initial phase of Atkins, which, again, Dr. Atkins only insisted you'd stay on for the first 2 weeks. Some people do decide to stay on induction longer, but Dr. Atkins considered this an initial phase. Now, after those first 2 weeks, daily carb intake on the Atkins diet is increased by 5 grams per day on a weekly basis. In other words, you eat 25 grams of carbohydrate per day for a week, and then 30 grams of carbohydrate per day for a week, and so on, until you find a level where you are losing steadily, but not at a breakneck speed, and where you're still in mild ketosis with all of its benefits, the clear-headedness, the suppressed appetite, all that stuff. And you stay at that level of carbohydrate intake till you've lost the weight you need to lose, and then you once again increase your carbs in teeny little increments until you're neither gaining nor losing to find your maintenance level. Now, keep in mind that your maintenance level may change over the years. Mine has gone down as I approach menopause. But on the other hand, it might increase a bit if I, say, started walking 5 miles a day. So your critical carbohydrate level, your carb limit, may change as you, you know, do this for the long haul. But it's pretty easy to learn to adjust it. Now, once the Atkins dieter is through that induction phase, which, again, only has to last 2 weeks, fruit is allowed so long as he or she stays within their daily carb limit. Since fruits vary widely in carb content, you can eat more of some of them than of others, okay? Fruits really vary a lot in carb content. For instance, a cup of halved strawberries has 11 grams of carbohydrate, which will fit into a pretty tight carb limit, as will, say, half a grapefruit, which is about 10 grams of carbohydrate. A medium banana, on the other hand, has 27 grams of carb, and a medium apple has 25 grams of carb. Now, that doesn't mean that you can never, 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 never again eat these things, but if you choose them, you're going to have to skip something else, possibly all of your other carb-containing foods for the day, depending on what your carbohydrate limit is. It's just a matter of deciding what's important to you. All of this entirely overlooks, by the way, the fact that before his tragic death, Dr. Atkins embraced the net carb count concept, what I often refer to as usable carbs, pioneered by doctors Michael and Mary Dan Eads in their excellent book, Protein Power. Now, this is it's now a very common practice of subtracting fiber grams from total carbohydrate grams to find the number of grams of carbohydrate that you actually digest and absorb. Because fiber is a carbohydrate, but it's a carbohydrate that you can't digest or absorb. That's why you can't live on grass the way a cow does. Well, using this method of subtracting the fiber grams from the total carbs, we find that an apple has only about 20 grams of net carb, which will fit a little more easily into your diet, especially if you use it more as an ingredient. You know, if you were to, say, use a half an apple and a big batch of tuna salad or something like that. On the other hand, a cup of raspberries has only 7 grams of carb once you subtract out the fiber, and a cup of raspberries is a lot of raspberries. So this is a useful concept. Further, using this subtract the fiber principle, you can have nearly 40 cups of shredded romaine lettuce for induction levels of carbs, 20 grams of carb a day, since shredded romaine has 1.55 grams of carb per cup, but 1 gram of that is fiber. So it's just over a half a gram of carbohydrate per cup. You could have virtually all the lettuce you could eat. You could also have that much spinach or cabbage. This amounts really to pretty nearly unlimited salad greens, enough for any vegetable fanatic. You may have to go a little easier on some of the more borderline vegetables like tomatoes or onions, but I trust the point is made that the Atkins diet allows for plenty of produce. And indeed, we are the people who are always doing things like eating pureed cauliflower instead of mashed potatoes and asking for the insides of the sandwich on a bed of lettuce. We actually, most of us, end up eating more vegetables, if we're doing it right, than we ever did before we went low carb. Please, folks, take the time to read Dr. Atkins' New Diet Revolution, or if you prefer, New Atkins for a New You, also very good, rather than just assuming you know what the diet entails because, you know, a friend told you about it or because, you know, you've read about it in some women's magazine article. It's a whole lot more livable than many people assume it is. And I say that as somebody who's been eating low carb quite happily for 16 years now. So, folks, do read the book. It's worth it. Well, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about my first tentative adventures in gluten-free land. And we're also going to talk a bit about low-carb school lunches. But first, I want to go back and touch on a concern that is tangential to this whole discussion about net carbs and fruits and vegetables and stuff. And that is the use of the whole net carb concept by food processors. Now, Drs. Michael and Mary Dan Eads only suggested subtracting fiber grams from total grams of carbohydrate. That is the whole net carbs concept as originally conceived. Okay? The only thing you subtracted was fiber. Unsurprisingly, the food processors, eager to cash in on what they viewed simply as a market, especially during the Atkins boom year of 2003, expanded that net carbs concept shamelessly, claiming you could subtract out all manner of things, that you could subtract out sugar alcohols, also sometimes known as polyols, that you could subtract out what they call resistant starch, that you could subtract out any sugar with a low glycemic index. This is stretching things to the breaking point, if you ask me. Okay? Well, where sugar alcohols are concerned, let's talk about this a little bit. Where sugar alcohols are concerned, I actually count different sugar alcohols differently because they behave differently in the body. Maltitol is the most commonly used polyol or sugar alcohol in commercially made sugar-free sweets for the simple reason that it behaves the most like sugar. You really can get virtually any flavor or texture that you could get with sugar using maltitol. Just as commonly, you see all of the grams of maltitol subtracted out from the net carb total. However, about half of the maltitol you eat will be absorbed in your gut. Now, it will be absorbed more slowly than sugar, so it is a lower glycemic index, it's true, but still it is absorbed. It is a carbohydrate that your body processes. Accordingly, when I am reading the label on sugar-free chocolate or no sugar added ice cream or whatever, I ignore the manufacturer's net carb count, and instead I calculate it myself, subtracting out any fiber and half of the grams of maltitol, figuring I'm going to absorb the other half. This 50% figure also applies to xylitol and isomalt, which are also both absorbed at roughly 50%. Sorbitol, it turns out, is the one most absorbed and is sometimes absorbed almost as much as 80%. Erythritol, on the other hand, which is the sugar alcohol polyol that is used in Truvia and some of the other stevia polyol blends, erythritol is virtually unabsorbed. It really doesn't go through the gut wall at all. Accordingly, I don't count grams of erythritol. I just don't. I consider it free. And it's also nice because it has almost no gastric distress associated with it, unlike maltitol, which of course is famous for making people socially offensive. Therefore, erythritol is one of the ones that I'm using more and more often in my own cooking. Polydextrose is one I'm seeing more often in processed foods. I can't get it to use in my own kitchen, but I looked it up, and polydextrose is also completely unabsorbed. So if you see polydextrose listed on a food label, you don't have to worry about that. It doesn't need to be counted. There is, I am sorry to say, one manufacturer of a lot of low-carb products who lists on their label a sweetener they are calling low-glycemic monosaccharide. And they claim that because this monosaccharide has a low glycemic index, you can discount it entirely from the net carb count. Now, I am sorry to inform you that the only low glycemic monosaccharide of which I am aware is fructose, which is pure carbohydrate, completely absorbed by the body. And despite having a low glycemic index and therefore not jacking your blood sugar around too bad, it is very bad for you. Now, I have written the company that I am speaking of, and I have asked whether low glycemic monosaccharide is a nice way of saying fructose. And they have simply danced around the question, neither confirming nor denying that their low glycemic monosaccharide is fructose. They have thrown a whole bunch of jargon at me, a whole bunch of verbiage, but I'm bright enough to read it and realize nowhere in there does it actually say, no, 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 we're not using fructose. They didn't say that. This total lack of candor intensifies my suspicions. One thing is certain, a monosaccharide of any variety is a sugar. That's what the word means. Monosaccharide means single sugar. Okay? Period. Monosaccharide is a sugar, and I don't care how low the glycemic index is, I won't eat anything made with what's called low glycemic monosaccharide. I certainly don't think you can subtract it from the net carb count, and I have to warn you that fructose appears to be uniquely fattening. It causes non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. It will raise your triglycerides like nothing else. And furthermore, it can even cause gout. So I'm staying away from the low glycemic monosaccharide. Then there's the whole Dreamfields question. Many, many people are very excited about Dreamfields. This product is very definitely high carb. It's made with pretty much the same ingredients as regular pasta. But, of course, they claim to have manufactured it with some kind of matrix that keeps you from actually digesting and absorbing the carbohydrates in it, and you just pass them through. I have heard too many reports of high blood sugar after consuming Dreamfields to completely trust that claim. Now, the company claims that if you cook it more time than is listed on the label, and I believe it says 8 or 9 minutes on the label, but I haven't eaten this stuff in so long, you can't hold me to that. Read the label yourself. That if you cook it any longer than it says on the label, that matrix breaks down and the carbohydrate becomes available, and that accounts for people getting big blood sugar spikes after eating Dreamfields. The same, by the way, holds true if you reheat Dreamfields leftovers or if you cook it in anything where it's going to be soaking in a sauce or a broth for any length of time. You certainly wouldn't want to use it in chicken noodle soup. You wouldn't want to use it in a skillet supper where it, you know, simmers with everything else. This is way too touchy for my liking. And anyway, I'm not eating gluten anymore, and Dreamfields is made from wheat. I'm just saying that you have to cast a skeptical eye on manufacturers' listed net carb counts. Just look at them with a skeptical eye. When in doubt, use a glucometer. I really think everybody who has any concern for their blood sugar should have a blood sugar meter. By the way, little hint, if you're buying a blood sugar meter and, you know, you're going to have to pay for everything yourself because you're not a diabetic and your insurance doesn't cover it, compare the price, not of the glucometers, but of the test strips. That's where you're going to be spending the big money, is on the test strips. I bought a CVS brand, house brand meter and used generic test strips from, you know, CVS house brand test strips. And they're about half the price of the ones from the big manufacturers. So anyway, when in doubt about a product, test your blood sugar before and after eating the product and see just how much your blood sugar jumps. Figure that your blood sugar will rise about 5 points for each gram of carbohydrate you eat. If, you know, 20, 30 minutes after you eat a product, your blood sugar has jumped substantially, you know that product is not for you. By the way, that does not apply to low glycemic monosaccharide, which is indeed low glycemic, but still bad for you. If you don't care to, that is assuming it is fructose, which again, I suspect it is. If you don't care to stick holes in your pinkies, and I understand that, even though I stick holes in my pinkies all the time, stick to the good old rule. If it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Okay. So that's the word from me, at least, on net carbs. Let's move along. We're going to talk about low-carb box lunches in a minute or two. More LaCroix. This is the Cran Raspberry, one of my favorites. We'll talk about the box lunches in a minute. First, I've had a ton of response regarding my review of the book Wheat Belly by Dr. William Davis. It is clear that a whole lot of low-carbers are now also going gluten-free or at least are no longer deliberately consuming wheat products, are dropping the tortillas and the bread and stuff. In the interest of helping all of you and helping myself, I made a couple of phone calls. First, I called the Hershey's Company to find out for sure whether sugar-free Reese's. Hershey's makes Reese's. So I wanted to find out for sure whether sugar-free Reese's peanut butter cups are gluten-free. Well, the nice Hershey's customer service lady, who was named Maria, told me that the labels on their products are always explicitly clear about potential allergens and trigger foods such as soy, wheat, and nuts. If wheat isn't mentioned, then there are no wheat-sourced ingredients in that food. This is the case with the sugar-free Reese's Cups. It is also true with the sugar-free Hershey's Special Dark. These candies are not manufactured in a gluten-free facility, however, so to be really safe, they don't label them gluten-free. But Maria said that the Hershey's company does go to some trouble to prevent cross-contamination between various, you know, products. If you are really super sensitive, if you're the sort of person for whom the faintest trace of gluten is going to mean an intestinal flare-up, or if you have what I talked about on the last show, the gluten ataxia, where every molecule of gluten you eat is increasing your brain damage, yeah, you still might want to skip these and look for sugar-free chocolate that's made in a specifically gluten-free facility. But if, like me, you're avoiding gluten on principle just because you think it's a bad idea, it's just not good for you, you might, you know, choose to eat the Reese's sugar-free peanut butter cups. They are still in my kitchen cabinet. They were in my mouth earlier today. At a reader's request, I also called the Dove Company to ask about their sugar-free chocolate. Dove has a consumer information line that includes information about which of their products are gluten-free, so obviously this is a big deal. I am happy to report that all the Dove sugar-free chocolate is gluten-free. It is also super yummy. Having tried it, I can tell you that. I have also been doing some experimenting with reduced-carb, gluten-free, yeast-raised bread. I have only tried twice so far. I am here to tell you it is not easy. In yeast breads, in the bread we're all familiar with, gluten, the protein in wheat, develops into stretchy elastic strands as the dough is kneaded. Indeed, the whole purpose of kneading bread is to develop the gluten into those long stretchy strands. And those stretchy strands of gluten create billions of teeny-weeny balloons that inflate as the yeast creates carbon dioxide, and that's what makes bread rise and makes it nice and light. Well, taking out the gluten means there's no stretchiness to the dough to create that structure. Gluten-free breads generally rely on our old friends xanthan or guar gum to create some structure. And guar and xanthan are, of course, low carb, but they don't really make a stretchy dough. So there's not as much lift as there is in a gluten containing dough. So that's the gluten-free part of my bread. How about, though, reducing carbs? Yeast-raised bread in general cannot be zero carb. It cannot go seriously, seriously low carb because it's the carbohydrate in the dough that feeds the yeast so that they produce carbon dioxide and puff the bread dough up. Most gluten-free bread recipes depend on gluten-free grain, flours, and other starches. Yes, these are carbohydrates. Most gluten-free bread recipes and other baking recipes depend on rice flour, millet flour, sorghum flour, potato starch, tapioca starch, stuff like that. I am using some of these in my experiments, but to keep the carb count to a level that my body and presumably some of your other folks' bodies can handle, I need to dilute those high starch ingredients. And that's the way it always happened when I was making gluten-based low-carb breads, too. You had to dilute the carbohydrates with other ingredients. In most low-carbohydrate breads, much of the carbohydrate is replaced with fiber. That's how we do it. I have also commonly used almond meal and or protein powder along with the fiber. However, all of these ingredients can make dough heavy, which will lessen the rise. We already have a compromised rise because of the no gluten, and then we're making the dough heavier too. So I've been playing around. Like I said, I've tried a couple of times, trying to come up with something that is acceptably bread-like, but that will not jack blood sugar around too badly. I've tried twice now. I have been busy. I tried once in my bread machine and once by mixing the dough by hand and baking it in the oven. The bread machine version is better. It's still kind of heavy. The hand-mixed bread rose okay, but I took it out of the oven too early. It was soggy in the middle, and it collapsed. I put it back in to finish cooking it through, but by then it had deflated, which made for a dense, soggy center. I think that recipe actually might work out if I baked it long enough before taking it out of the oven. Well, so it goes. The recipe game can be rough. There are ideas I have tried a half a dozen or more ways and never had them work out. Still, this one, you know, it seems worth pursuing. Those are of you who are 100% grain-free, which is a very good place to be, I might add, will not be interested in any of this, but I know that there are many people who have been depending all along on low-carb bread and low-carb tortillas and yet are now worried about gluten. So I will do what I can, folks. I will let you know how it goes. So let's move on to low-carb voices. Yay, low-carb voices. We didn't do this last week, so I'm or 2 weeks ago. So I'm happy to be doing it again. The question for the past few shows has been about box lunch ideas, lunchbox ideas. Especially, I wanted low-carb lunchbox ideas for kids to take to school, and especially, after I reviewed Wheat Belly, I wanted low-carb lunchbox ideas for kids that don't involve gluten-containing stuff like low-carb tortillas and bread. In other words, not just, oh, well, take your usual ingredients and put them on a low-carb tortilla and make a wrap instead of putting it on Wonder Bread. Well, this is a tall order. And it is one of those subjects where I'm at something of a loss. Yes, I know a great deal about low-carb food. On the other hand, I have no children. But a quick Google turned up pictures of some really cool new lunchboxes. Apparently, lunchboxes have changed quite a lot since I was a child. And they now make these boxes with a whole bunch of little compartments inside. And it strikes me that these would make the whole low-carb lunch thing easier, because I'm thinking some cheese chunks in one compartment, maybe some chunks of ham in another compartment, some baby carrots or pepper strips or celery sticks in another compartment with a little container of ranch dressing. Maybe in another compartment, you could put some mixed salted peanuts and sugar-free chocolate chips. That's assuming, of course, your kid's school allows peanuts. Or you could put some cocoa roast almonds, you know, Emerald cocoa roast almonds or cinnamon roast almonds in one of the containers for a little dessert. This sounds like a lunch most kids would like, even without the usual sandwich. You could also do sliced pepperoni or salami and sliced mozzarella, roll them up together, and include a little snap-top container of sugar-free pizza sauce to dunk them in to make kind of pizza-flavored things. Please skip the Go-Gurt in your kid's lunch. Go-Gurt has way more sugar in it than it does protein. Last I looked, it had about 2 grams of protein in a Go-Gurt container. It's candy. Don't do it. But you could do a snap-top container of full-fat Greek yogurt with, you know, a little sweetener of your choice and some vanilla in it, and then add frozen berries to it at home. That'll help keep it cool till lunch, and that would make a great lunchbox item. Do kids take thermoses to school anymore? A wide mouth thermos lets a kid take chili and soup and things like that. All mom or dad would need to do is make extra one night while cooking supper, and there you go. You got a few school lunches. Also, tuna salad, chicken salad, egg salad, there's no law that says these things have to be served as a sandwich. How about a container, a snap-top container of one of these salads, that's the word I'm looking for. Are you worried about that mayonnaise? Well, here's 2 points about the mayonnaise. First of all, research shows that commercial mayonnaise actually retards spoilage. Now, it does also have undesirable omega-6 fats in it, so that's your call. I probably wouldn't use homemade mayonnaise and send it to school unrefrigerated till lunch. but commercial mayonnaise actually retards spoilage. Secondly, if you'd be unafraid to send one of these salads in sandwich form, if you would not be afraid to send a tuna salad sandwich to lunch with your kid or an egg salad sandwich to lunch with your kid, it's no more dangerous than a snap top container. I think it would be fun to send along some lettuce leaves along with the salad so your kid can make lettuce wraps. For this purpose, I might well use iceberg lettuce since it's going to stay crunchy longer than leaf lettuce. Leaf lettuce tends to sog a little quicker. Try putting your lettuce in a Ziploc bag with a damp paper towel to help it keep moist. Well, here's a call we got about lunches from a nice woman who I can't tell whether her name is Tara or Kara. And I'm sorry, Tara or Kara. But she's from Columbia, Maryland. And she's been kind enough to call in and tell us what she packs for her kids' school lunches. So give a listen.
Hi, Dana. This is Kara from Columbia, Maryland. I'm calling in regards to your healthy, low-carb lunchbox ideas. These are also gluten and dairy-free options for kids. One of them is I take deli turkey and pepperoni, and then I make them into different shapes and stack them so they have like little mini sandwiches, but it's just turkey and pepperoni. I also make flax meal bread and then use a little bit of low-sugar deli and almond butter for their baked peanut butter and deli sandwich option. I do chicken salad wraps. I do heat containered meatballs, like a little thermos with meatballs in it. I make zucchini muffins using coconut flour, which is another easy way to get their vegetables in. That's about it. I also chop up cooked sausages and just slice them up in little circles, and they, give them a toothpick, they'll basically eat anything. So love the podcast, keep it up, and thank you.
I just love that statement. Give them a toothpick and they'll eat anything. I think that's so great. As is the idea of meatballs in that wide mouth thermos. I mentioned the thermos, but it never occurred to me to put meatballs in it. I think that's great. And that also, the idea of the toothpicks gives me an idea. How about making little kebabs? I mentioned, cubes of cheese and ham and stuff. How about doing little kebabs of a cube of cheese, a cube of ham, and a cube of turkey, maybe even a grape tomato on a toothpick, and maybe even throwing in some kind of sauce or dressing that the kid could dip the little kebabs into. As for the flax bread that she mentioned, I don't have the recipe for that, but Laura Dolson, who runs the low-carbohydrate page at about.com, has a recipe for flaxseed focaccia. I've tried it. I think it's quite good. I will have Kevin, the producer, throw up a link on the show page at danaslowcarbforlife.com. And Tara or Kara, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thank you so much. This is really helpful. And we'd love to have your flax bread recipe. Hint, hint. Need I add here that anything that can go in your kid's lunchbox can go with you to work? And there's one more possibility, probably more popular for grown-ups for lunch than kids, but you could use it for the kids too. How about putting a few hands full of bagged salad in a snap-top container with any other easy veggies you might have on hand, if you have some of those grape tomatoes or maybe, some diced pepper or something. Throw that in. Add a handful of cubed ham or turkey or shredded cheese or canned tuna, cold cooked shrimp, chopped hard boiled egg, anything you have in the way of cold cooked protein, and put the lid on the container. Put your favorite dressing in a little snap top container. Don't put it on the salad first thing in the morning and hold it till lunch. Your salad will be a soggy mess. Put it in a little snap top container. Or if there's a fridge at work, just keep a bottle in the fridge. When lunch rolls around, pour on the dressing. You got a main dish salad. My sister took this, she's a teacher, and she took this to school for lunch every day for years. So this week's question for Low Carb Voices is one that I know a lot of people struggle with. What do you eat when you want something crunchy? A lot of people want to know, what can I eat that's crunchy on a low-carb diet? And I'm pretty sure that the answer they want is not celery. Do you eat pork rinds when you want something crunchy? Do you eat nuts? Do you eat something else? And if you eat these things, do you eat them plain? Do you vary them somehow? Do you use a dip? Do you add some seasoning? Bonus points if you've got a recipe to share. But that's not the only reason you can give us a call. You can give us a call if you've got any kind of an idea you want to share, or a question, a recipe, an idea for a low-carb treat. We're coming up on the holidays, so we're going to start soliciting holiday ideas pretty soon. Really, anything you want to share with the low-carb community, call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262, and let us know. If you have any friends you think might like the show, please steer them to the show page at Dana's Low Carb for Life. And if you like it, how about leaving a review at iTunes? We love that. Don't forget to check out my blog at holdthetoast.com. You never know when I'm going to throw up a recipe I just tried. Join my Facebook fan page at Dana Carpenter's Hold the Toast Press. There's lots of great folks there. That's a fun, ongoing conversation. And at both places, both at holdthetoast.com and at my Facebook fan page, Dana Carpenter's Hold the Toast Press, you're going to find links to other low-carb resources, so you can branch out. I mean, you know, I'm not the only source of information out there. God knows, and there's some fine, fine people out there. So go look at my blog roll and stuff. And of course, a reminder, 300 low-carb slow cooker recipes is now available at Amazon.com, as is, of course, 300 15-minute low-carb recipes. Order through CarbSmart.com if you prefer. Along with your other stuff. If you've already got either book and you like it, please go review it. If you hate it, don't tell anybody. That's it. Remember, till next week, stay low carb for life.
This is Dana Carpenter saying thanks for listening. If you like today's show, please leave a review at the iTunes store. You can always leave questions and comments at 412-385-DANA or write us at feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. For complete show notes, please visit our site at www.danaslowcarbforlife.com, and don't forget to visit the blog at holdthetoast.com. Special thanks to Disc of Light Media and our sponsor, CarbSmart.com.